Coming up on Tech News Today, a new sneak peek at Office 15, how Public Radio International accidentally lied to you about Foxconn, and what's good for the NSA, not so good for Google. All that and some iPad stuff next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, March 16th, 2012, iPad Day. Tech News Today is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to Netflix.com/twit. And by Ford, featuring Curve Control to help protect against crashes on curves. Look for Curve Control available in the 2013 Ford Taurus, and you can learn more at Ford.com/cars/Taurus. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Aya Zaktar.
I'm Darren Kitchen.
And I'm Jason Howell.
And it's Friday. Happy Friday, everybody.
Thank you.
Happy Friday to you, too.
You know what else it is?
What?
It's iPad release day. And all the stories that you will read in Tech News Today will be about iPads. We're going to get it out of the way at the beginning. We have new iPads.
Yeah, they were released from their cages, their cardboard boxes.
Speak for yourselves.
Actually,
a couple of fanboys over here.
Shannon walked in.
Box right over there. Don't play that.
Shannon came in the office just earlier today, and she got infected, too. Now I come into Twit, and I see that it's hit you. Did it hit you,
I
Ayaz?
Right there, yeah.
Sarah, you
no,
were okay,
I don't
there,
even
right?
like iPads. I just do a show
Aren't
about
there two
them.
Two behind
so.
You?
That's right. Play cool.
That's just for your job.
I think I actually remembered all caps.
Before they sold out, you know.
The pre-order, that is.
Yeah. I liked iPads before they sold out, and I couldn't order one. The new iPad teardown continues from iFixit. We talked about the battery yesterday, apparently. There's also indication that it's a Samsung processor or a Samsung parts in there. Mm-hmm. The A5X processor is in there. So you can follow iFixit to see the innards of the iPad if you're interested. The other interesting thing out there is that some folks took an AT&T SIM card and popped it in the Verizon iPad and found out, hey, it works.
Best of both worlds.
Yeah.
Except one of them's AT&T, so not really.
Yeah. You can't do the reverse because Verizon SIM cards only work on LTE.
That's
because... Can't pop it into an AT&T iPad and use it.
That's because the iPad roams internationally on GSM, right? So it's built in.
Probably, yeah. That's the best guess. Yeah.
And one of the weird things was when they showed the teardown and they showed the logic board, it did match that leaked one that was out there for a while.
The picture was almost exactly the same.
So
the leaks are getting better.
Yeah, apparently people can get access to these things a lot easier than they used to.
Frankly, I was not all that impressed when I took it out of the box. It looks like the iPad 2. The screen is a little better.
Were you hoping that despite everything you'd read, it would look totally different?
I don't know what I was expecting. I was just like, well, it just looks... I mean, it looks the same.
On it.
The screen is a little better, but it didn't like blow me away right away. But as I started to use it, I started to see things. I'm like, oh, yeah, that definitely looks better. That looks nicer.
Now, did you get it?
I was more blown away with the Apple TV, frankly.
What?
Okay. And you didn't get an LTE model.
No,
so it's
I
not
got
as
a,
if you
I got
can.
A Wi-Fi.
The LTE, which is a Verizon model, at least in our house, I actually have a LTE AT&T, so I'll be able to compare the two, is 3 times faster than our Xfinity Wi-Fi.
Oh, nice. Wow.
We've done a variety of tests. I don't know if that means Comcast sucks more or Verizon LTE works really awesomely.
Well,
it's a little of both.
I wonder with all the iPads sold, all the LTE versions, is that going to take down that network a little bit?
I think within 2 months, we might have a different story.
Yeah. And back to the resolution thing, like I had a hard time going from my iPod Touch to my original iPad because I could just see the jagged edges everywhere.
I think you have better eyesight than me.
I just couldn't unsee it. And then once I went to the iPad, I'm like, yes, okay, this is consistent. And now I'm looking at my laptop and I'm a little annoyed at it. I can see little jagged edges. So
it's ruined it.
Damn.
You know, actually, if you get one of these, the Galaxy Note, come on, the only tablet worth having.
Oh.
If you get 4 Galaxy Notes, you'll have the same screen size and 512 more pixels in horizontal resolution.
Is there a program that will split up a video image across 4 so that you can, like seeing a panel full of televisions, you could see one picture on 4 Galaxy Notes?
Probably, but it's Android, so it's really going to be...
So those creases wouldn't bother you at all, huh?
Yeah,
exactly. It's almost better. I actually think that the iPad 2, I never had an issue with the resolution. People would talk about Retina display and, it could look just as good as the iPhone 4. And I thought, yeah, I don't know. I've never really had a problem with the way this looks. Movies look nice. You can zoom into stuff. But once I've seen the new iPad and you go back to the iPad 2, it's like having HD video and then going back to an SD signal. It just looks awful.
I tell you, the thing that stood out to me the most with the Retina display was when I played a standard definition version of a Firefly episode, and it looked like crap.
Right.
Which it looked fine on the previous iPad. It's like that's where the extra resolution made a difference. So I'm like, oh, this actually doesn't look that good. I need to get the HD version and download that. Or the higher, the 1080p version.
They're a little more expensive.
Guess what? I will say Apple TV, the new Apple TV with 1080p.
Awesome.
Oh, my God. It's fantastic.
It's so much better.
Given the limitations of the apps and what you can do with it, that part isn't awesome, but the picture is amazing. Just taking iPhone videos that have been shot on the iPhone 4, not even the 4S, and putting them up on the TV, they scale so well. So I'll give that some props.
What I think is beautiful here now is that your little 10-inch tablet has a higher resolution screen than your 60-inch TV at home.
Oh, I know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm like, I'm just not going to watch anything on television anymore.
Well, this stay far away, enough away from it. Everything becomes a Retina display if you can't see the pixels. So
right.
10 feet back on a 40-inch, this whole
well, why are you sitting 10 feet back, though?
Or 8 feet. Did you ever play
Atari? You're supposed to be within the 2-foot range.
But then you see the little
Burn
your retina for your display.
I never saw the pixels in my Atari games.
All right. The antidote for all of this Apple iPad hysteria is Microsoft Office 15. Now, you were talking to Paul Thurrott about
this. Bring us back to Earth.
I'll bring this right into the ground with Microsoft Office 15 preview. Okay, now Paul Thurrott got his hands on the technical preview, and he posted a ton of screenshots over at WinSuperSite. Now, what he did was he ran it on Windows 8 Consumer Preview. According to Paul, the installation standout was Microsoft My Site Documents, which I didn't know what that was. But he understands that it's going to replace SharePoint, so I guess that's more of a...
Oh, right, a link is built in and all that. Right.
So a lot of enterprise kind of stuff in there. But after the install, the start screen, you know, that beautiful thing with all the tiles that people are either they like or hate, has a ton of Office 15 tiles, something like, I want to say, 18 of them. There's a ton of them. It's just, there's a lot of applications, so they put them right on your start screen.
Well, it reminded me the first time I installed, I don't remember which one, maybe Office 98 or maybe the one after that, where it populated the start menu like 100 different links into the different Office stuff.
Yeah.
It seemed like the Metro version of that.
And Paul was like, I hope Microsoft comes up with a more elegant solution. But this is the preview edition. And again, he had screenshots of things like Word, and he said it had a decidedly friendlier face, this is his words here, than the previous version. Again, he confirmed that there's a minimized ribbon by default. There's a new full screen mode where a lot of the Chrome goes away. There's also a lot of Microsoft ID integration. And on top of that, you can save things directly to SkyDrive. Once you sign into Windows 8, that's your account, so you're locked in there. So you can go, you can save all your files right to SkyDrive right there. And the big takeaway is, it looks a lot like Metro, but it's not a Metro app. It's a desktop app, so it's completely different. And the SkyDrive integration, that's just pretty dang cool.
So if you folks want to hear more about Office 15, you want to discuss that, watch Windows Weekly. Iaz and Paul and Mary Jo had a great conversation about it. You want to learn more about the iPad, the new iPad, watch iPad Today. Leo and Sarah are going to record that right after TNT.
Yes, special episode for all the live viewers.
But round the horn, I kind of like the sound of Office 15. Frankly, these screenshots Paul put up look pretty nifty. I'm a little more excited about that.
I'm kind of excited about Microsoft this year in general.
Really?
Yeah. I don't currently have a Windows machine, but I would like to get one because I'm starting to feel a little left out on all this stuff.
On the Metro style.
Yeah, I think it's exciting that Microsoft has so much coming out this year and they're changing a lot of things up significantly, and I think that they should. I think it's working for them.
Darren looks frightened.
I'm excited for Sarah, but I moved over to Linux, so I have like no reason whatsoever to ever buy a Microsoft
product. But you look at Office 15, and you're using OpenOffice, or LibreOffice, I guess. Are you jealous at all? You're like, ooh, that looks cooler. It looks like better styled.
Honestly,
LibreOffice do everything.
We've had all of that in Emacs for years.
You haven't had all of that in Emacs.
Well, anyway, that's
what
I feel.
But it doesn't do anything that you care about.
No, if I were buying a PC today, I mean, and I was living in that corporate world where it was kind of a necessity, yeah, I'd be excited because it looks a lot cleaner.
Yeah, I love the saving right to your SkyDrive. Mm-hmm. I think that's brilliant. It's almost
they
obvious.
They had that kind of before, though. You could just save to SharePoint.
And My Site Documents, including SharePoint, I think is kind of the other piece of that puzzle you're talking about. Yeah. So I think this is all good stuff.
It looks like they're really just making a lot of the stuff that they've had a lot easier to use. Because it used to always be like the most people only use 2% of Office. Well, maybe now they'll use like 5%.
Yeah. And more of their brain, too.
No, there's Clippy's going to pop
Microsoft
up.
Microsoft can't do anything
that.
About that.
Am I the only one who's hesitant about Microsoft Office right now?
Are you?
I'm a little bit, because it shows that if they're this far along, even though it's a technical preview, they have a long way to go before it's polished. And if Windows 8 is polished as Windows 8, because there's a lot of things that are just not exactly right. There are weird pop-up windows that still come up for options. There are things that just aren't as clean as they should be right now. And it seems like they're struggling to figure out which way do we go. This is kind of Metro-like, but it's not a Metro app.
But the other side of that is it's consistent. It says, look, we know it's not a Metro app, but we want the desktop apps to look consistent with the Metro feel.
That's the thing, and that brings up weird inconsistencies. That's the strange thing, because they want to satisfy desktop users and the Metro users.
But you're talking about the style. Are there functional things that bother you?
Oh, no, functionally, it's solid.
Well, I don't think it's a bad thing to have the style reflect Metro, so that when you go from Metro to the desktop, it's not as jarring. I think that's smart.
Well, I'm hoping that this will get better, so I'm a little tentative on it.
All right. A lot of people were not tentative about This American Life's report on Foxconn, but maybe they should have been.
Yeah, so it turns out that This American Life, it's a very beloved show that runs weekly on NPR, has retracted its most popular episode to date. This was an episode that focused on working conditions inside a Foxconn iPad factory, relied heavily on the information from one Mike Daisy, if you go to his bio on his website, he calls himself an actor, author, commenter, playwright.
Performance artist,
also. But a lot of it based in the technology realm. He has a long-running show, The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, which is sort of like almost like a one-man play, which was considered the best play of the year by the Washington Post. Got accolades from New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post. Anyway, he got together with the folks from This American Life to give them information on bad working conditions, basically. The point of the show was to uncover reasons why, you know, we've heard stories about, workers want to commit suicide and they're all getting ill there. He was providing the show with a lot of very damning information against this company that obviously was working closely with Apple. Turns out that he lied to NPR's fact checkers, at least about some of the material.
You know, we should make a point. It's aired on NPR, but it's actually Public Radio International through Chicago Public Radio.
Yes,
This American
it's a
Life.
PRI.
So PRI probably deserves the attribution there.
Yes.
Somebody in the chat room pointed that out.
Yes,
and that's a good point.
Thank you for saying so. That's very true. It's just part of NPR's roundup. One of the stories was about N-hexane poisoning, which he had said, oh, yeah, I met some people that were in Shenzhen, which is one of the plants, the Foxconn plants, who were very ill, and I spoke to them, and I got sound bites. Turns out something like that did happen, but in a plant in Suzhou, which is about 1,000 miles away. He has admitted now that the folks from This American Life have gone public and said, listen, we fact-checked, we believed him, some of the stuff panned out. We did not do an adequate enough job about looking into some of the claims that he made because we were giving the benefit of the doubt. We screwed up, we are sorry, and we are retracting the show. This coming episode, which airs over the weekend, is going to be an entire hour devoted to what went wrong, what's really the story, and trying to dispel some of these myths that had arisen. Mike Daisy, for his part, says, "What I do is not journalism." This is something that he posted on his personal blog. "The tools of the theater are not the same as the tools of journalism. For this reason, I regret that I allowed This American Life to air an excerpt from my monologue. This American Life is essentially a journalistic, not a theatrical enterprise, and as such, it operates under a different set of rules and expectations." This reminds me of the man who went on Oprah to talk about his autobiography about overcoming drug abuse and then said, you know, I should have told you that I made up some of those autobiographical parts of my life.
Yeah.
It's.
I think Daisy is saying it's poetically true. I'm capturing the essence of what happens at Foxconn, but the facts aren't true.
Right. It's a little unbelievable that anybody would have been in any way confused as to what This American Life would want to get at. They don't need artistic license when it comes to facts about who Apple might be working with, especially when it pertains to people being treated unfairly, human rights issues, and sickness.
Well, what if he was really confused and he thought This American Life was from The Onion or something?
He's like,
yeah,
not.
Sure, I can. No. There's really no excuse for this. There's really little to say about this.
You know, what's interesting about this particular episode is not only was it extremely popular, certainly in the tech community, it was.
It fueled a fire that was already burning.
It did. In fact, the same week, it helped along a New York Times article, which, by the way, New York Times did not just lift a bunch of information from This American Life. They had their own sources. So it is a separate issue. But those two together really caused a tidal wave of public interest about what's going on in Foxconn. There were petitions that were started online. I mean, it really, I would say, forced Apple to start making public statements about this stuff.
Now, the problem here is this is going to further muddy what is already a difficult issue to wrap your head around, mm-hmm. because of cultural differences, because of translation differences, because of things that are easy to misunderstand because of the sheer scale of Foxconn. It's not to say that there aren't conditions at Foxconn that need to be remedied, but it's already hard to, when you say, like, there were this many suicides, it sounds horrible. But then when you go by a percentage of the number of people who work at Foxconn, it starts to sound not great, but at least more understandable. There is still an investigation going on at Foxconn, mm-hmm. by an international organization, and they made a lot of statements when they first went in and began their investigation, and people criticized them for that. But we have yet to see those conclusions. So hopefully this doesn't swing people the other way to being entirely uncritical of Foxconn.
Right. This does not mean that Foxconn is a great place to work.
But it also, it shows that maybe there was a little hysteria, mm-hmm. around wanting to vilify Foxconn, because everybody wants to believe a good Upton Sinclair story about the sausage being made in a horrible way.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, let's take a quick break and thank our sponsor, Netflix.com. You want some good documentaries, actually? Good place to go to find them. Most of them are even true. Check them out. Netflix.com/twit. They also have unlimited number of movies and TV shows. You can watch them on your television. You can watch them on your tablet. You can watch them on your phone, through your game console, through your Roku box, through your Apple TV. They are everywhere. In fact, I was really impressed with the implementation of Netflix on the Apple TV, frankly, where they got Netflix to agree not to use the standard Netflix interface. They use the Apple TV interface. And it just fits seamlessly right in. Check it out. You can get it for free for 30 days, netflix.com/twit. Or if you already are a Netflix subscriber, pass that URL along to somebody who isn't. netflix.com/twit. We thank them for their support of Tech News Today. Onward to some privacy issues. And we have a trio of privacy issues.
Oh, you mean like the palm?
Like privacy issues served three ways.
Oh, see, I hear trio. I get reminiscent from the 650 back in the day. Anyway.
Trio. Handspring. Trio, if you want to really go back.
Yeah.
But no, sadly, nothing that pleasant. Google facing new investigations. Wall Street Journal reports people familiar with those investigations say that the U.S. Federal Trade Commission is now examining whether Google's actions in getting around the Safari cookie block. Remember that? Where they were using what it's actually.
Wait. You're talking about the thing where the programmers were just like, listen, this is the code that works around the problem of today. My boss put this thing in my desk and it says, hey, make the thing work, and I had to do this to make the thing work.
Yes, that very same.
Okay, that thing.
FTC now investigating that, whether it violates the legal settlement with the government. To violate that settlement with the government, they would have to show intention, and Google has already said this was an unintentional side effect of another process, so it'd be hard to prove that. However, a group of state's attorneys general, including New York's Eric Schneiderman and Connecticut's George Jepson, also investigating this. They can levy their own independent fines, independent of the FTC. And the French Commission Nationale de l'Informatique et des Libertés, or CNIL, has added the Safari circumvention technique to its existing pan-European investigation into Google's privacy policy changes. So Google already under investigation everywhere for privacy violations, now going to be adding this to the list. Meanwhile, a group of 13 individuals in the United States District Court for the Western District of Texas have filed suit against 18 companies for surreptitiously gathering data from the address books of tens of millions of smartphone users. So this is what PATH, mm-hmm. was all in hot water for. And among the companies being sued are Facebook, Apple, Twitter, and Yelp.
So 13 people that care about privacy.
Don't make too much about the fact that it's just 13. I mean, you wish it should be a class action if it gets much bigger, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just 13 people happen to team up on this one.
Yeah, and when this news gets out like it is right now, people will join this and it'll be a larger class of people.
But essentially, they're going after these folks for uploading address books to servers without properly notifying.
Okay, well, that I stand behind.
Do we think that there's starting to be anti-privacy hysteria? Are we overdoing it? I'm all for...
Wait, is it anti-privacy or pro-privacy?
No, I think we're not overdoing it. I think that there's, like, basically an awakening, and so there's, like, a backlash.
Because we have ignored our privacy rights for so long?
Pretty much.
Now suddenly people realize how far they've eroded?
I'm actually... No, I'm serious. I think that's really what it is.
Fair. I think it's the way the normal... A press writes this, you know, when Google installs tiny tracking files or cookies. Like, I mean, that's been around for a long time.
I know, and that's the thing,
so,
is consumers just gloss over the cookies.
But when you see tiny tracking files, you're like, tiny tracking files? They're following me, and then you start freaking out.
I can't see them because they're tiny.
Exactly. And then there's something called a cache, and I don't know what to do, and I think it's silly sometimes because it's easy to panic about this. And you're like, oh, yeah, well, yeah, of course my browser kind of knows what I'm doing. Why wouldn't it know? I mean, it just seems a little strange that you would just think, oh, yeah, this... I get this piece of software for free, and I can go everywhere. What are they getting out of it?
Well, you know...
Something.
But at the same time, you start to see, like, other projects. Like, one of the things that killed from the doc earlier, or I think you guys talked about yesterday, was, like, the anonymous OS, you know, and things like that. So things of that nature are spawning because in response to people just saying, like, look, I'm fed up with this. I just want, you know, to
be
able to surf the web.
Or better example.
But, you know, those are, like, you know, attack tools. I'm talking about ones that, like, you know, there's a actual... The Onion Router has a... It's not officially their project, but they have... A bootable ISO that basically is like a browser, that's like Chrome OS for Tor, you know, and things like that wouldn't exist if there weren't that kind of, like, you know, backlash from consumers that are just like, you know what, I'm fed up. I don't want to have to deal with this anymore.
But I think, as usual, we don't have a fair assessment of what the real threats are and what aren't. I mean, Google, with the Safari circumvention, arguably did break the law, or at least break ethics. But I don't think they did anything horribly damaging. They wanted to serve a more targeted ad. A more targeted ad isn't a bad thing. If you're allowing ads in the first place, wouldn't you rather they be relevant?
Which you can opt out to anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, they publish, like, all over, like, here's how you just take your stuff and go home.
So I'm not sure this is the best example of a privacy violation. The uploading of the address book bothers me a little more because that's personal information.
Yeah, that I cannot get behind. And that's where, like, I think mobile, where we are right now in mobile is where we were with, like, Windows machines in 1995. You know, it's only a matter of time before you've got Bonsai Buddy on your Android phone. And, oh, you rooted it? Great. Rootkit time. Because, or if not, in PDF vulnerability. And anyway, what I'm saying is we're kind of like in an infancy stage of in a new area of computing, and we're going to make the same mistakes all over again. And, you know, the privacy thing is, it's just ever so apparent to us when it gets written up, and then it's really easy to freak out about.
Putting some cookies on your machine, even uploading what are essentially public email addresses to a server without your permission, though, pales into comparison with what Wired Magazine's James Banford describes in his recent article about the setup of the Utah Data Center being built for the National Security Agency in Bluffdale, Utah. The article details not only the creation of a gargantuan server farm that is several acres, hundreds of acres large, bigger than, like, eight times bigger than the White House complex, I believe, but also details how the NSA is tying it into the warrantless wiretapping program, which has been going on since before 2008, got legalized essentially in 2008. Where
so it no longer violates the Constitution.
Right.
I mean,
no longer violates the law.
Oh, okay, okay. But like Google and Path and all of them, they can, you know, violate the law and the Constitution. But we're talking about the NSA here. So let's just, you know, we can pass laws like FISA that will just kind of grant immunity to the people involved. And it's okay.
AT&T and Verizon have NSA offices in their offices where the NSA taps into the phone and the internet systems that are run there. Wired Magazine's James Bamford talked to William Binney, a senior NSA crypto mathematician largely responsible for automating the agency's worldwide eavesdropping network. Binney left the NSA in late 2001, shortly after the agency launched its warrantless wiretapping program. He says, quote, they violated the Constitution setting it up, but they didn't care. They were going to do it anyway, and they were going to crucify anyone who stood in the way. When they started violating the Constitution, I couldn't stay. And he talks about how they could have set up traps where information was coming into the transatlantic cables and only monitored international conversations, but they said no, and with good reason. We have operatives in domestically that we want to go after, and now they're building, at least in this article is described, building a system where they are managing yottabytes.
Yeah, this is
going to
help them expand the global information grid. So this way they're going to be able to basically, like before, from what I read from the article, it was just a matter of like, okay, we've got a suspect and here's his acquaintances and his friends of friends and how much data do we keep? And now they're just going to be able to say, well, keep all of it. Because, you know, even if you can't crack it today, you might be able to crack it tomorrow.
Right, because they, at the Oak Ridge National Data Center, the Oak Ridge Laboratory, they have a public scientific computing effort going on, but they also have a secret NSA effort, at least according to this article, that is working specifically on building enough of computing power to crack AES.
Yeah, you're talking about Jaguar, the 2.3 petaflop supercomputer that ranks third in the world. And the data center that they're building in Utah would be able to potentially house something like, if you just scaled that out, orders of magnitude larger in computing power, which really has me thinking like, you're talking about AES, right? So AES came out 2001. And it's been secure until now. And it comes in three different flavors, 128, 192, and 256 bit. And it's what a lot of consumers use. You know, we no longer use the old DES stuff that came out in the late 70s. That had a shelf life of like 25 years. But when you look at technology and the exponential growth, if the previous tech lasted 25, this one lasting 11 kind of sounds, I mean, I might be putting my tinfoil hat on here, but I'm kind of thinking that, you know, if you did have something where you're like, okay, we can prove it once. Now we can scale it. Big money would come and you'd be able to scale it when you're the NSA. So it makes me a little, tinfoil hat about when it comes to like AES 128.
Yeah, because I mean, that's something where people think, oh, well, I'm safe enough. No one could ever look at this. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is the NSA is doing this because their main motivation is to go after the bad guys. And we want them to go after the bad guys. That's their job. But they are not including the Department of Homeland Security in any of the public addressing of the fact. And they've done a few press conferences. They've done a few, like an opening ceremony that's described in the article. So this is definitely done on the QT. And we don't know what the oversight is. How do we stop them from going past doing what they're meant to do, which is getting the bad guys? We want them to be able to do that.
Like, the same thing with the wiretapping. There was like an oversight committee that was supposed to be able to like see these problems and stop them from happening. But as we know, that didn't happen.
The center goes up September 2013 is when it is expected to get running.
In this case, the first time the NSA tries to go after somebody, an American citizen, right? And if they try to prosecute this guy, if the person has enough resources, this and this is a constitutional issue, if this person can appeal to that point, I mean, this seems
you're assuming this goes into the public or in the courts at all.
Well, I mean, the thing is, what are they going to do with that data, right? They have to use it for something.
Mm-hmm.
And if the data is used to prosecute somebody, I'm just kind of curious, you know, when can they test the constitutionality of this? Because it's going to, if the oversight committee has to be the Supreme Court, then I guess that has to be the case. Because you don't have one of those.
But there isn't any test because it's all done in secret and it's all extremely confidential. And
right, but if it's data to try to get somebody locked up or something, you're going to have to present that as evidence.
What are you going to point to? What if they don't lock them up publicly? What if they aren't arrested through the normal system?
Oh, you mean like a secret police kind of deal?
I mean, that's the kind of thing that this is another step towards. I'm not saying that they're suddenly creating secret police, but if they've got this, yottabyte, 500 quintillion pages of text stored in yottabytes of information in a data
storehouse.
There's
only one reason that you would need that kind of storage and that kind of computing power, and that is to break encryption. And the more storage, the better, because the more examples you have of somebody using this key over and over and over again, the more that you can throw at it and find those collisions, and the easier it becomes to crack that stuff. And I'm not saying that I'm against, like, you know, us being like, you know, do that awesome Jack Bauer stuff, but at the same time, as a hacker, and when I say that, I mean, like, you know, a security conscious and privacy conscious individual, this kind of stuff is really what makes me start looking at even stronger encryption.
I mean, it's almost Godwin's law to bring up Watergate in discussions like this, so I hesitate to do it. But to address your point, Watergate took a lot of effort to drag into the public scrutiny and turn into cases that were tried. And it was only because of a couple of mistakes made early on that if they hadn't been made, no one would have ever known it had happened. So it's not inconceivable that a lot of abuses could stay under the radar for a long time. Again, I'm not saying that the NSA shouldn't be able to monitor people confidentially in order to protect our safety, but there needs to be some matter of oversight of it, and there needs to be some scale restriction to it. And that's what...
What do you mean by scale restriction?
Well, and that's essentially what William Binney was saying, is we don't need to get all of the data. What we need to do is prioritize it and say, this is the data that seems most likely to help us. Let's go after that. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, we're just going to take it all. And that's what leads to the possibility of abuse, which is we're no longer doing what's efficient to go after the bad guys. We're just taking it all, and it's sitting there. And somebody eventually could be tempted to go, well, I know we didn't take that data for this purpose, but it's there. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do some data mining.
Right. And then, you know, 10 years from now, when it's, you know, super easy to just cut through that encryption, then, yeah, you've got that huge log.
All right. Let's finish up with Microsoft issuing a patch for the Windows Remote Desktop Protocol vulnerability. But there's some controversy swirling around it, Darren.
Yeah, well, you know, the whole idea here is getting proof of getting a remote exploit out of this. So let me back up here. Tuesday, March 13th, Microsoft issued a patch, the MS-12020, which basically addresses two issues with RDP, or Remote Desktop Protocol, a moderate one and a critical one. And if you're not familiar with RDP, or Remote Desktop Protocol, it's what a lot of admins use all over the world globally. It's kind of like the standard. It comes with Windows for just being able to interactively log into a PC from afar and take care of like management tasks. And a Italian security researcher, Luigi
Ariema.
Ariema. Responsibly disclosed this to Microsoft in November, and Microsoft even said that they figured the vulnerability would take an independent researcher about a month to come out with working exploit code, but that was before the code leaked from Microsoft. So Microsoft actually shares this code with, you know, a bunch of other partners of its. There's even other vendors that use this kind of code to put into intrusion detection systems and things of that nature. But unfortunately, it has wound up on a bunch of like pastebin-like sites in China and now made its way all over, and everybody's really having a whole lot of fun with it, because right now it's pretty simple with what's circulating to make a server that's running Remote Desktop Protocol that hasn't installed this workaround to crash, to BSOD, to blue screen of death. And it's pretty much just a matter of time before a remote exploit, that is, piece of code that allows you to get a server from afar to do whatever you want, without even touching it. It's kind of great in that sense, to come out. And so once that comes out, then it's going to get really scary, because everyone uses this. This is on like ATMs and servers everywhere. So Microsoft issued a patch, but it's more or less a workaround on Tuesday that basically implements this thing called network level authentication. And so with that, you're in the clear for now, but I'm sure.
But you need to implement the patch.
You need to implement it, yeah. So
it's always an issue. Yeah.
Also, if they knew about it in November and they thought it would take an independent researcher about a month, we're coming up on April now.
Yes, but Microsoft only releases patches on Tuesday, because that's what's best for the consumer.
What about a Tuesday in December?
Yeah, seriously.
Well, you know, it takes a long time to write code.
They had like four of them at least.
Yeah.
I'm sure they'll write code faster now.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting that you need a bounty to go after a patch vulnerability.
The Hacker News is reporting that H.D. Moore, the founder of Metasploit, which is an awesome framework for doing all sorts of remote exploitation and other fun hacking, supposedly put up a bounty for $1,500. I've seen it over at gun.io.
So if you can help him out, you can get $1,500.
Yeah, there you go. I'm sure, though, Luigi got a little bit more than $1,500 from Microsoft. Those blue hat guys, they like to buy exploits.
All right, let's check out the news fuse. Google, you've got some splaining to do. Android app developers in Europe are ticked because Google hasn't been paying them as scheduled. Their February fees were to be paid on March 7th, but that didn't happen. It's March 16th now. Google responded to the first complaint after 6 days and said it is investigating.
Hell hath no fury like a dev who needs
Where's
to
money?
Be paid.
70%.
The deal between LightSquared and Sprint is officially dead.
Aww.
Yeah, Sprint will hand back $65 million in payments given to it by LightSquared. Considering the FCC blocked LTE's network and Sprint's jumping ship, analyst Roger Etner of Recon says it's the clearest sign yet that the wireless venture is doomed.
Doomed. There's trouble in the Apple Store, the Apple App Store with a capital T. No. The New York Times reports Ryan Pearson was charged over $400 for virtual currency in a game he never played. The Times also reports this is not an isolated incident, and there are hundreds of complaints online questioning Apple security.
With a capital T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for Pearson.
Thanks. Wow. I really wish I had thought of that.
That's wonderful. Get this. Another file-sharing site is under legal scrutiny. A German court ruled that RapidShare must actively filter uploads to stop by users to stop the spread of copyrighted content. And, get this. RapidShare hasn't said whether it will appeal to the decision.
A J.D. Power & Associates survey says that the Apple iPhone is tops in customer satisfaction when it comes to smartphones. Using a 1,000-point scale,
oh, wow.
Apple scale. Users reported a satisfaction rating of 839. The next closest was HTC with 798, the average being 774. This is the seventh straight time Apple has been in the top slot. J.D. Power surveys smartphone users every 6 months, and they're recognized as sort of an arbiter of customer satisfaction.
1,000-point scale. What's the thinking? 100 just isn't working for them?
I guess they're just trying to shake it up.
It's just put a decimal in there and then call it 100-point.
These scales are silly.
Yeah. The Verge is reporting that the first Windows 8 tablet that'll be the first to market will come from, drum roll please, Lenovo. The tablet will be powered by an Intel processor, and Lenovo is betting on an October release of Microsoft's newest OS.
Dashing the hopes of many, a Microsoft spokesperson told Bloomberg that, quote, there will be no talk of a new Xbox hardware at E3 or anytime soon.
There will be no talk.
Don't you dare.
He continued by saying, quote, for us, 2012 is all about the Xbox 360. Optimists are spinning this to mean that we might get a new Xbox next year.
Okay.
Lenovo is not the only one. According to Android and Me, Google has selected Asus as its hardware partner to produce the next Nexus tablet. Expect a 7-inch device with a price range of about $150 to $200. And the site was unable to get any more details on specs.
$150? Whoa.
Yeah.
Cheap.
That'd be awesome.
Gaming site MCV UK reports the handheld Neo Geo X will launch in the second quarter of this year as a limited edition and could cost £500. The device would be preloaded with 20 games, including King of Fighters 94 and Fatal Fury.
That's awesome. I love Neo Geo.
Let's check the randomizer.
Randomizer.
I'm a sucker for a new alphabet. So when I saw this article from Scott Merrill on TechCrunch about his meeting with Craig Muth in Columbus, Ohio, and Dotsies, I was actually amused. He has created an efficient alphabet. So it's based on the Roman alphabet, A, B, C, D, right? But it uses dots in different locations and then another dot above those dots to indicate capitals so that you can save space and have an efficient English alphabet displayed.
I love the way the website discusses this. That since Latin letters are optimized to be written by hand, they take up lots of unnecessary space.
It's true.
Your eyes have to move at a frantic pace. I never think of it when I'm reading. It's a frantic pace, but it really
it's crazy.
You're trying to figure out what these shapes are.
This is like when the hard drive manufacturers put the magnetic rods like upright instead of sideways. It's like, dude, look at the compression ratio on that alphabet. What I'm really stoked about is Craig also developed a cording input method for the dotsies. You guys familiar with this? So basically, this is where you put your hand on the keyboard. So like all of your digits go on a key, and then they never leave that key. So what? For like an A, you put this finger down, but maybe for a B, it's two of these fingers down.
Oh,
and for a Z,
okay.
It's like three of these fingers down.
No. I hate this.
Why?
No.
Because Sarah hates change.
You really hate everything, don't you?
No, I don't hate everything. I just like the language as it is.
I just never get to say that.
I feel like
else.
It's taking up too much space. I'm a very good typer. I don't want to do this piano nonsense when I'm typing a word.
I think, Sarah, you need to get
it's
with the
a
time.
No from me.
Like, Tom and I, we've already switched over to binary so that we can talk around other people and they wouldn't even 1 1 0.
True.
001.
00111001.
Somebody's going to translate that and email that in.
But if you need to speak Esperanto, mm-hmm. This could come in really handy.
Mm. I like
it. I ink they is they is a oopid stay.
So good at that.
They could print New Britannica's like on one sheet of paper with this language.
That's right.
This great.
If they wanted
right.
to go back
they
to
keep the print edition.
If they wanted to keep it, they just
the hard covers would be thicker than the paper.
We could use this. NSA would never know.
I misspoke. Canucks, like, Ace to Tech said zero for true.
I did not. Or were you lying? Everything he says is a zero.
Yeah, exactly. Let's move on to the calendar.
Ring. It's the second annual Northeast GNU Linux Fest on March 17th, 2012, which just happens to be St. Patrick's Day. So they're a dedicated bunch. It's in Worcester, Massachusetts at Worcester State University, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Be there.
Green Wear beers green. And GNUs.
I was thinking right. Green penguins.
Green penguins. That too. Also, the London Web Summit is taking place next Monday. Yeah, next Monday on March 19th in London.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. London, well, London, England, UK? Not London, right. Ontario.
That's correct.
London, Kentucky.
It's not a UK, John London's London. House.
Right.
Yeah.
What's incoming?
Incoming message.
Oh, a message. Good. We have one from Marlin, actually, who notes that you can donate to U.S. Kickstarters even if you don't live in the U.S.
Hi, good day, TNT Show. This is Marlin, the guy from Trinidad. Hey, what up, Jason? I just wanted to call about donating to the Kickstarter project, donating to Kickstarter, because I donated to Kickstarter all the way from Trinidad and Tobago for the Double Fine project. Do you know that when Tim Schafer was putting out his update videos, he did put out one way that persons from Europe could also donate to his project? So it might be good for the European viewers to probably go back, take a look at his update videos. I can't remember exactly how they did it, but they did show how even European persons and people like me in the Caribbean can donate to Kickstarter projects. So that's what I give you that tip. Okay, bye. Love
good,
the show.
Yeah, good to know. I mean, we were talking specifically about European people setting up Kickstarter projects to solicit donations, but we didn't make it clear that, and I didn't know, frankly, until you called, Marlon, that you could still donate to the U.S. projects internationally, which is cool. We also got an email from Joel in Halifax who said, I also feel the pain expressed by Will Harris on episode 458 of No Easy Access to Kickstarter. He's talking about as a business person setting up a Kickstarter to fund your thing. He said, to create a Kickstarter, a project has to be by a U.S. citizen and have a U.S. checking account. Now, a lot of international people have partnered with folks in the U.S., get around it that way. Joel says, it's my understanding this is mostly due to the fact that credit card transactions and payment delivery for Kickstarter projects are processed through Amazon. There is an alternative to Kickstarter for non-U.S. folks called Rocket Hub at rockethub.com. It operates in much the same way as Kickstarter with a few key and unfortunate differences. The biggest of these occurs when a project on Rocket Hub does not reach its funding goal. Not only does the money still change hands, which is baffling, but in addition to the credit card processing fee of 4%, Rocket Hub doubles their fee on failed projects from 4% to 8%. A non-funded Kickstarter project has zero risk and no fees. It's no wonder that Rocket Hub doesn't have the popularity and success of Kickstarter. Come on, Kickstarter. Rest of the world's waiting. As always, thanks for everything, Joel Dugan. It's worth noting that some international Kickstarter projects have been successful. They simply have a U.S. partner, he mentioned. So thanks for that, Joel.
Next email from Fred in Glasgow, Scotland. That was weird. When talking about the Nokia design chief dedicating one-third of his time to the Nokia tablet, Will Harris suggested that only one-third of anyone's attention would result in a substandard product. I'm in industrial design. I'm an industrial design student. And one of the most important parts of creative and design process is time away from your given project. Within the design cycle, it's known as incubation. My lectures have been known to pretty much insist that students step away from a project, especially when it's particularly taxing, and go to the pub for a beer or two. Heck, in some cases, the staff join us. So dedicating one-third of one's time, it's probably the best amount in order to give the best design decisions. Just a thought, especially for Liquid Friday.
Mm.
Thanks, Fred. Yeah,
that's, incubate more ideas.
Well, we talked about how one-third, does it really matter? Is that just sort of an arbitrary number? And it's nice to hear something from the industrial design side. Thank you, Fred.
Next on email. To the next email, Ayaz.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah.
I was like, I didn't know there was one. Sean from Apple Valley, Minnesota wrote in and said, hey, TNT crew, I just finished listening to episode 458 where you talked about the laser unprinter. I work for a company that services and repairs laser printers, and the talk about reusing cleaned paper made me cringe a little. The more times a sheet of paper is used, the more likely it is to jam somewhere in a printer. Factors that include static, moisture, physical damage, and general wear and tear on the paper can cause major headaches. I'm also sure that everyone can think of at least one person who would forget about an errant staple or paper clip that would make a costly call to us necessary. So in short, new paper good, use paper bad. Just make sure to stick the old stuff in the recycle bin.
I think we can all agree that PC load letter needs to die.
Yes.
Yes, that's awesome. But
what does that mean? PC load letter?
PC what?
What the?
But what's on PC anyway? Aren't we in the post-PC era?
Post-PC era.
All right, before we go, I want to thank our other sponsor for today's show, Ford, featuring Curve Control. Curve Control is part of a suite of safety technologies on the 2013 Ford Taurus. It helps drivers maintain control of their vehicle when taking a curve too quickly. Here's how Curve Control works. First, it looks for potential problems by measuring how quickly the vehicle is turning versus how quickly the driver is trying to turn it. Roll rate, yaw rate, lateral acceleration, wheel speed, and steering angle. Calculations run 100 times every second, and when it finds a problem, Curve Control rapidly reduces engine torque, applies four-wheel braking, slows the vehicle up to 10 miles per hour in 1 second, and it works on dry or wet pavement. Curve Control helps protect while driving on curves, and it's one of several new driver assist technologies available in the 2013 Ford Taurus. You can learn more about Curve Control at ford.com/cars/Taurus. And of course, as always, we thank Ford for their support of Tech News Today. That's it for this episode. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. You can vote on stories, as always, in our subreddit, technewstoday.reddit.com. You can also submit your best of moments. Don't forget about that. If you saw something on the show, you're like, we want to see that in the highlight reel. Let's not forget that. Send it to tnt@twit.tv and use the subject line best of. We got a lot of them this past week.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, we did.
I guess we had some good moments.
During Pi Day.
Lots. Yeah, maybe it was mostly the Pi Day stuff. Always good to have you on Fridays, Darren.
Yes,
and you've got some good stuff coming up on Hack 5.
Yeah, get this. If you're a geek in the Bay Area and you want to come out and do some Wi-Fi hacking, I'm holding a Wi-Fi hacking workshop at the Noisebridge Hackerspace in San Francisco on May 30th. Go ahead and head over to hack5.org/workshop. Find out how to get involved. Build yourself one of these. It's going to be a lot of fun.
I noticed that you got quoted in the CNET article about how to protect yourself at South.
Yeah, yeah. I ended up accidentally hacking both Declan and Eleanor. So that was a lot of fun.
So you're saying I should book you and Declan on the same episode of Tech News Today sometime in the near future.
He thought it was great. He came by and he's like, anyway, he's like, what are you doing here? I'm like, replacing the internet with cats. And he's like, a Nyan cat? And that's when I knew I had him.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You had him in the end, kid. All right, that's it for this edition of Tech News Today. You can find us on the web, twit.tv/TNT. You can email us, tnt@twit.tv. And you can give us a call, leave us a message, 260-TNT-SHOW. We'll be back on Monday with Ken Denmead from the Geek Dad blog.
Yay. See you then.